Can I just two or three words? I mean, you've heard Adam or Hanif, but it's Adam really. It's an old Hanif, aged 65. He's a lecturer. It's a first-person story, and he's just explaining. There's no need for me to go into details. But he meets Ralph just by chance, Ralph has something to do with the theater. He's a young playwright, and he gives him the possibility of choosing a body. So my question, in fact, about the first part of what you read, when I read this part, I thought that, in fact, it was full of hints for various short stories, which you just, in fact, gave us. You don't give us the full story. For instance, you suggest the possibility of changing the body for the body of someone with another sex, of a woman, or then of a colored person. Now, you don't follow this up. There's one thing you do. There's a surprise. The fact that the body, the young body, you've noticed is the body of an Italian football player with the face of Alain Delon, of a young Alain Delon, which is going to keep, by the way, only for 6 months. Six-month sabbatical from his wife, he says. I'm quoting you. So the only surprise we get, and the surprise he gets, and which he couldn't know, of course, is that it's the body of a homosexual. He had no idea. But he didn't choose, for instance, the body of another sex, which would be a good beginning for a short story. So have you been tempted sometimes to go a little bit further in all those suggestions, for instance?
Well, I got interested in the idea because I watched a lot of television, particularly late at night, and there were lots of there seemed to me a couple of years ago, lots of programs about people who had plastic surgery. And they showed them before, then they showed them having the surgery, and then they showed them afterwards. And I was fascinated by these programs, and I'm very, very interested in celebrities. And very interested in, say, Jerry Halliwell's body. And in the bodies of stars, and people wanting to change their bodies, and so on. So I began to think that after a while, you'll no longer get, you know, a new nose or a new arse or new breast, that you'll just get a new body. It seemed obvious to me that all this tinkering around was hopeless. It would be like buying a new car. And having always been interested in identity, I then began to think what this would mean. So it's like a conceit, I guess. And there is a tradition of English writing like this, but particularly I was thinking, for instance, of things like Frankenstein or Dorian Gray. And you're right, when you were saying that, he could have been a woman, he could have been, I don't know, a black man, or he could have been this or that. I thought, well, of course, you have all these choices of other ways in which the book could have gone, or he could have tried out a number of different bodies. I guess somebody else will have to write those stories.
Yeah, it's good of you to give the ideas.
But what I was interested in, what I became interested in was the fact that it's something to do with wanting to make what's obvious to you, that you have a body and other people have bodies, and you spend a good deal of your life looking at their bodies. That's what you look at most of the time and think about. I thought, this is actually rather unusual. And of course, if you have children, they think about their bodies and ask you about your bodies all the time, and they're always looking at bits of your bodies with great curiosity and so on. So I thought that I wanted to take a sort of naive approach. What is it like to have a body? What do bodies do? What do bodies mean? What would happen to me if I had a better body than I have now, or a different body, or a different face, etc., etc.? So it's to do with thinking about identity and what it is that, you know, my body means to me and to other people. But also to do with being, I guess, being an Asian person. When I walked down the street when I was a kid, people would go, oh, there's a Paki. And so you'd think, ah, I'm a Paki now. And so my body would be, that of my father's, would be read by others as Paki. And therefore being a Paki came with a whole, you know, range of descriptions of me, which I then had to think about what being a Paki meant, for instance. So you can see that your body determines the way other people will think and speak about you, and therefore the way you'll think of and speak about yourself. So there was a very, you know, good comic aspect to this story, but also something quite serious about it as well. It seemed to be a good combination.
Okay, thank you.
So you chose for this short story, in fact, the form of a novella or a long short story.
It's not, it's not a story. It's not a short story. It's more of a tale, I guess.
It's a long short story.
So, could you tell us what you favoured in that form in comparison with the novel, for example, or in comparison with the short stories that follow in this collection? Why did you choose this particular form of the novella?
Well, what I do is I start writing at the beginning, and then you write for a bit, and then after a bit you stop when you've said it. And so that's it, really. And if and I always try and make them longer because the publishers like them to be longer. And they're always, when I wrote my novel Intimacy, lots of people complained. You get an advance from the publisher, and lots of the publishers said, "Whoa, it's such a short book, we're only paying half the advance." You know? And it was hilarious because I thought, well, maybe, okay, well, I'll write a bit more, you know. And they said, no, that would be an artistic. But I'd say, you know, you write a bit more, I'd get paid more, wouldn't I? And then you could weigh it rather than read it. But when it comes to form, I would say that normally what you have is the story first. You know, you want to tell this particular story, and then you begin to develop it, you write around it, you experiment with it, and it comes out in the shape or length or whatever that it does. It's not something that you decide in advance. But I think if you're writing short stories, you tend to write a lot of short stories at once. Mm-hmm. I would do that, say, for a year, and then I think, God, I'm so bored with this, I want to write something more substantial, and I would then work in another form. But it's usually the nature of the story that determines the form rather than the other way around.
And it's interesting because in this same volume, there is the last short story, which is, I think, wonderful, which is called Touched, and which is this time a very short story, and which deals also with the body, because it deals with a young man who is touched by an old blind lady.
Yes.
Could you tell us more about this short story? And did you think of it in relation to the body, the novella?
No, it's just based on there was a lady who used to live at the top of my road when I was a kid. And she was blind, and I would go to her house and she'd make me tea and I would talk to her. And after it occurred to me, either then or the other day, I can't remember which, that she was the only person who didn't realize that I was an Asian, that I was brown. And there was a lot of racism which really bothered me when I was a young man. And I found it rather liberating to be in front of a woman who didn't have this idea about me. So I began to think about this, and I wrote a story about it, I guess. But it would be very hard to think of a novel that wasn't about bodies.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It might be about lots of other things, but mostly books are about bodies, I guess.
Or your books.
Yes. Yeah, I was wondering whether really the body isn't like a sort of a signature tune in all your works, starting from what we really discovered you with, most of us here, the film My Beautiful Laundrette, for instance, and we remember the shock scene at the time of Day-Lewis kissing the young Paki, his friend, amorously kissing the... that's already the body. But then also the fact that you have so many actors in most of your novels and short stories. So this would be my question, really. And in many of your novels, including in The Buddha of Suburbia, you more or less have your characters explain the fact that really what a director wants from an actor or a playwright wants from an actor is to really put himself into someone else's shoes, or in French even better, dans la peau d'un autre. So is there, do you see a connection then between this interest you have for the body, for bodies, and including intimacy, of course, which is all about bodies, which perhaps...
I remember when we were doing Intimacy, I remember Patricia Chéreau and I would talk about the bodies in the frame. We would talk about it as though it were a painting. And he said to me once, he said that what I do is for a living is I move bodies in space. And I try to make it look good. And generally he does. I'm interested in performance, I guess. I mean, I've always worked with actors and I also like dancers and singers and so on. People who, what they do is they show you their bodies for a living. And that seems to me to be an odd job and rather exciting, rather dangerous job. And the idea of watching an actor do something is something that has always fascinated me. But of course, at another level, you are looking at somebody's body moving in space. Why would that be interesting? Why would that be fascinating? And what would you think about their body? What ideas would you have about their bodies? But I think this body stuff is everywhere. I mean, it would be odd to watch a film, go and see a film in which there were no bodies, there were only landscapes. After a bit, you'd want somebody to walk on, wouldn't you, and do something. It would seem strangely empty.
Yeah. Before we came, I suggested, we had a short conversation, to tell you the truth, and I suggested the fact that your interest with bodies, there was one of your conversations with Patrice Chéreau, in which you mentioned your interest in painting, and particularly of Lucian Freud and Francis Bacon. So I was wondering whether, to follow up this theme of the bodies, you might one day think about painting or the use of photographs or even choreography. I mean, this would be another way of perhaps pursuing this.
Well, I guess what photographers or painters or writers are trying to do is to get at something which is enigmatic about other people, which is the fact that you don't know what other people are thinking and feeling. I mean, you can look at their bodies and you can see what they're saying, but there is something that somehow always eludes you about other people. What are other people really like? Well, particularly if you're a man, what are men like? What are women like? What are they thinking about? You know, what would it be like to be somebody else? What are their feelings? And so we spend a lot of time scrutinizing other people, thinking about their bodies, their faces, their actions, in order to get some sense of what their minds are like, in order to, I guess, not to feel so isolated, not to feel so lonely. So I think painters and writers, all of us, are concerned about this thing, which is what it is. How do you know another person? And how do you know that you know another person? And what is really knowing another person like? And why would you want to know another person anyway? And so on. And therefore, just also talking about lying, talking about deception, and so on. So it seems to me that we are staring continuously at other people in order to know what other people's minds are like, and wondering whether other people's have minds at all often. Sometimes when I'm going mad, I get the feeling that other people don't have minds at all. That they're just, I don't know if you ever had this, other people sometimes are made out of cardboard, and you're living in a world in which you're the only person who's human, and everybody else is made out of cardboard. Do you ever have that? No? I must talk to my therapist about this then. But it seems to me that this is a question that all artists and probably all people want to know, which is, what are other people like? Particularly George Bush.
So have you got any plans about using photographs or doing paintings or having ballet dancing with the theme of the body?
I guess it's a question really about what we studied at university, the mind problem, mind-body problem. What do other people's bodies tell you about their minds, about their desire, what they want, and what they want from you? I write stories. And I guess that's how I try and make sense of what it is people are trying to do with each other and the ways in which they misunderstand each other.
Okay. We've just seen that the body is indeed a recurrent theme in your books. Another recurrent theme which I found again in this collection is the father-son relationship. Several short stories in this volume deal with that subject, and your previous novels have dealt with that subject also. Just to name your latest novel, Gabriel's Gift, was a wonderful book about the father-son relationship. In the collection of essays that has just been published, Dreaming and Scheming, you also talk about your relationship with your father. Does this subject interest you only on the autobiographical background, or do you go further than that? And have you seen an evolution in the way in which you've dealt with that subject over the years in the various forms, the novels, the short stories, the essays?
I guess I write about fathers because writing about mothers is worse. And harder and more complicated for me, as it probably is for everybody. And also because I'm interested in the way that the ideas you have about your parents never stand still. I think I always thought for a long time that after a bit I would make up my mind about my parents and I would stop thinking about them and then I would just go off and be an adult and that would be fine. What I realized is that when you're 5 years old or when you're 15 or when you're 40, when you're 60, you're still thinking about your parents, that they are alive inside you, you know, making you more and more crazy in all sorts of ways. But they never leave you alone and this, your ideas about them mutate all the time. And I guess everybody's like that. And I guess I will exist in my parents' mind, but also in my children's mind as well in this way. And so writing about it, it's like you have, you know, it's like an update. You get these new ideas. You think, oh, my God, now I'm writing a book, another book about my father. Can you believe it? It's unbelievable. Which is a book, I guess, of identifications, a book about the ways in which other people exist inside you. But you have these voices of these other people, your mother and your father, that work inside you, that speak inside you all the time. You are them and you are not them. They are each other and they are not each other. And all the time you're trying to separate yourself out and work out what it is to be them and not be them and so on. Also, my father came from India. He came from India to England and he was, I guess, an immigrant. And his life in England, therefore, was part of a historical period or a social movement that interested me very much, and also to do with race, colonialism, exile, struggle in a different country and so on. So there was a lot of sort of social stuff that my father brought with him that I could then think of as being history and then write about. It seems to me that I only try and write about the same things that everybody else is thinking about, which is what it is to be a child, what it is to be a child and what it then is to be an adult. And what it is these voices of these people who gave birth to you, what they do inside you all the time and how they change. And also the Freudian thing, how is it that not only do you have these parents, but how is it that everybody else in the world becomes to resemble them so much? That you feel that you are only ever speaking to your parents forever in the guise of other people. I was thinking that in the train today. I was thinking, this guy's looking at me really strangely. He's going to throw me off the train and I'm going to end up in San Get. And then I thought, oh, it's only because he, you know, I'm sure he reminds me of my father. You know.
Mm-hmm. Again, in your conversation with Patrice Chéreau, you wrote something about the body again, and you said that, in fact, probably according to you, our age would be unideological if you compared it with the preceding periods, the 60s and the 80s. And you suggested that the solution would be that now politics, and I'm quoting you, politics has moved inside into the bodies. So possibly could you explain exactly...
Well, that was true until September the 11th.
Yeah.
Yes. We lived in a very unideological age, it seemed to me, until then. But I guess it seems to me that people's politics or their social position or the way they live in the world is lived out in their bodies. That I guess I was thinking that to have a body is also to have an idea of what your body means, that people, the significance of different parts of your body have different meanings for you, that to be given a body isn't just to be given something that already comes with a meaning, that you invest it with meaning as you go. Therefore, to be a brown person or to be a fat person, to be an old person, to be a baby, is for others to have different ideas about you and for you to have your own ideas about yourself. I mean, one of the things about being brown was when you were young and people called you a packy or they abused you or they were racist, was that I found that you began to internalize these ideas, i.e. you become very, very paranoid. You suffer from extreme paranoia because you live in a world in which people hate you. So I was thinking that having a particular body can lead to having a particular kind of mind, and I was thinking about those connections.
That would replace the problems of society, I mean, the individual problems, then. Well, in other words, would be politics.
Yeah, what's called social or political problems would live inside your body, would be inhabited by these in certain ways, yes.
Very interesting issue.
There are, in this collection, there are a few echoes to previous novels. This is something that you do quite a lot, some kind of winks at the reader. For example, there's a character who is slightly alluded to called Dee Dee Osgood, who was actually a character in the Black Album published in 1995. So do you intend these echoes as indeed winks at the faithful reader? Is this a way of creating some kind of intimacy, some kind of complicity with the reader?
It's partly that I do it for you. and partly because the fact that the characters that you create actually are part of you, and you often wonder what they're doing now. So the characters that you make are like they're in a soap opera, and you think, oh, I wonder what Karim Amir would be doing today if I were to write that story today, or what some of the other characters. So it's as if when you're a writer, you make this world, and these people don't go away. They continue to people this world. They're bits of you, and you could bring them back in, and they could have conversations with one another. I guess to be a writer is to dramatize your mind, bits of your mind in all these characters, these people, who then stand for different bits of yourself, I guess. And you can, you know, they continue to exist, of course, as they always will, and they can have conversations among themselves.
You don't like them to die, then really keep them alive.
It is that. There'll be something tragic about having one of your characters die in that way, wouldn't it? Yes.
You are mentioning paranoia when you've been branded brown, black, or abused, or whatever. Have you ever felt schizophrenic? And I'm saying that because I know, obviously, you know, of your two, you know, origins. I mean, being, you know, Indian and British.
No. I've often felt that I'm going completely mad, certainly, like most people. It's interesting, actually. It's very interesting to think of what sanity actually is. I've been thinking about that a lot. You know, who is sane? Who has a good mind? Who has a strong ego? Who would you say was not crazy amongst the people that you know, when you think how eccentric people are? And I think as a writer, one of the things you can do as a writer or any sort of an artist is you can be as mad as you want to be in your art, I guess. You can be as extreme, as crazy. It seems to me that most writers live rather dull lives, actually. We don't do anything except sit in a room on our own writing. But when we're in there, we imagine the most mad, fantastic things, as do most people, except the writers write them down. So I guess I would say that I've probably experienced extreme states of mind, but it's usually in quite a safe place. I wouldn't go out on the street and do it, you know. And I wouldn't do most of the things that my characters do, but I can imagine that people could live like that. So it's a dull life being a writer in that sense. But you're free in your fantasy, I guess, to imagine whatever you like.
Well, I also meant it in terms of, you know, social status and belonging. You know, and being, you know, British, but not looking British.
It's never driven me mad. I could see that it would drive you mad. There are times when, I guess, when you are so isolated and frightened, particularly under racism. And Ralph Ellison describes this wonderfully in a book called Invisible Man, where he really is driven crazy by racism. But I have to say that, I guess, for reasons I don't understand, I always had quite a strong ego, and I think what happened to me was I felt that I was all right when I started to write back. If you're a young man and you're subject to racial abuse, you're subject to other people's descriptions of you. You know, you're a victim of the way they see you. And the way in which I overcame this idea that other people would talk about me in words I didn't like was to make my own words. So it was like a counterculture. When you begin to write back, you begin to counter the ideas, I guess, that other people have of you. So I began to tell stories. Began to write novels, which were probably rather like the Buddha of Suburbia. And when I did that, I began to feel more powerful. I began to feel, well, I can tell stories too. These are my descriptions. These are my words. This is my world, which I'm making here too. So there's the world that other people make of you, that you're a Paki, you're an alien, you shouldn't be here, you're an outsider, you're a colonial victim, etc., etc. And then there are words that you make that when you begin to speak back. So I became very interested in speaking and who speaks and who's allowed to speak and in silence. But when I began to speak, when I began to write my stories, I think I felt that I couldn't then go mad because I could tell these stories like Scheherazade, speaking for your life, you know. As long as you don't stop speaking, you won't die.
So what is your relationship with the South Asian community in Britain, in London and in Britain?
I don't have a relationship with the community at all. I just have a relationship with my friends, with people that I know. I mean, you know, it's like saying, what's your relationship with the French community? There would be no answer to that. I mean, Asian people are just like French people. I mean, there are some, you know, Indian and Pakistani and Ceylonese and different sorts of people who I'm mates with. And being a writer, I don't speak for the community, I don't speak for anybody else. I write the stories that give me pleasure in the hope that somebody else might be interested in them. When My Beautiful Laundrette came out, there were demonstrations in New York against the film by something called the Pakistan Action Committee. This was before the fatwa against Rushdie and before what's happening now in the world. But, you know, the Muslim community didn't like what I was doing. They were always going, "Whoa, there are no homosexuals in our community," you know. And they thought that when I wrote stories, you know, stories of people taking drugs, having sex and doing bad things, that this was not good for the community. I said, "There's nothing else for me to write about, is there? You know, I can't do advertising for your community." So I've always written freely as I want to write, and you know, some people in the so-called South Asian community like it, and others don't. You know, that's it, really. Yeah.
Yes, Kazuo Ishiguro, who was there not very long ago, once spoke about the idea that because his first two novels was set in Japan, many of his readers expected him to become a sort of a spokesperson for people like him, being born outside Britain and writing in English. Is this the way for you? Because on the other hand, this book of short stories, there's only one story, and the last one, which is a story we both like very much, the last one, where there is a young Pakistani. But have you found a solution, in fact, in dividing your works into fiction and non-fiction? And in your non-fiction, obviously, you do deal with political themes, and you may become the spokesperson for in-betweens, as some people say.
No, I don't speak for anybody. To be honest, I don't even speak for myself. When I write, I don't know, and I don't want to know where it's coming from. I write as close to unconsciousness as possible, so it's the most dreamlike and as mad as possible. And I certainly can't, you know, my words are not said on behalf of anybody else. People say to me, "Why don't you write a film about so-and-so?" I always say, "Well, you write a film about so-and-so, you know, it's your job." People have to speak for themselves, and they have to speak up, and they have to speak back, it seems to me. It's not something that I can do for other people or would want to do for other people. It seems to me that writers should irritate you and get on your nerves and say things. You know, a French writer who I admire very much and I think is a very good writer is Michel Houellebecq. And I'm very pleased that he's managed to annoy so many people in France. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that that's one of the things that writers are supposed to do.
Do you think The Body is a kind of very British work in the way that British people kind of often are portrayed as people who have problems with the body?
Everybody has problems with their bodies, yes. I don't think there's anybody, there isn't one person that you could ever meet who hasn't had problems sleeping, eating, or having sex, it seems to me. If you point to somebody who doesn't have problems with those, it seems to me that to be a human being and to have a body is to have problems. It seems to me that to be alive is to be in conflict and to have terrible problems the whole time. I've realized this as approaching 50. It seems to me to be an inalienable truth. To be alive is
I meant more the idea rather than the physical problems of a body, but just the idea of the body and sort of accepting it and recognizing it and kind of
recognizing the body and the body that the body has its needs and its desires, and somehow you have to come to some sort of agreement with your own body in some way, as if you have to, you and I, you, i.e. the mind and the body, have to get on in some way. We have to understand each other. We have to reach an accommodation. But it's never an accommodation that's final. Having a body is a nightmare, particularly as you get older, you will find, you know, when bits start to fall off and it starts to go wrong and all of that, then you really hate it. And of course, when you're 21, 22, you have a wonderful body, you never think about it either. You never think that you have a wonderful body. You just think it'll be like this all the time. So I don't think the idea that, for instance, the French have a very good relationship with their body... whereas the British are always trying to put their bodies in cold water. Which is true, they do. The body, you can't break it up on nationalistic lines, the body, unfortunately.
When you were choosing your body, did you say that you retained your brain?
Yeah, in the story, the guy keeps his brain, which he's very proud of, and he likes, he wants that.
Which leads what? The brain or the body?
Well, that's what he... most of the philosophers in this room have been thinking about this question for a long time, you know. Is the mind inside the body, or does the body make the mind work? Well, I wouldn't know the answer to that, nor would anybody, but that's what he's trying, that's what the story's about, really. What he thinks is, if he has a new body, people will see him differently. It's quite interesting, actually, because he comes back as a 25-year-old, and he doesn't realize that when you're young, people really patronize you. You know, he thinks he'll be really funky and sexy, and everybody will want to fuck him. In fact, what they do, ignore him, you know, and don't want to talk to him most of the time. And it's quite interesting that it doesn't quite turn out as you'd imagine.
He was a football player.
Yeah. Well, he doesn't know. He has this body. He doesn't quite know what happened to it. The homosexuals do recognize him in the street.
I think you should read the book because it doesn't really end as he had expected. And we are not going to tell you how it ends, but there is a surprise in the end. But also there's the fact that the society is divided between old bodies and new bodies, because he's not the only one to have a new body. So he does meet people who have a new body. And by the way, that's another good starting point for another short story, the fact that you mentioned that sometimes children in this new society are older than their parents, obviously, because they've changed their bodies. That would give another very good short story, perhaps, or long short story.
Sorry, I haven't read The Body, but I'm thinking more of your early novels, and I was wondering what the importance of sexuality is. Obviously, you're one of the contemporary writers that writes most about sexuality, and also the fact that many of your characters are actually homosexuals. What is the meaning of this?
Well, I was very interested in sexuality until the other day. I was in a restaurant with a friend of mine and we were talking, and I went to the bathroom and I came back and I realized at that moment that I'd crossed the line, that I was no longer interested in sexuality at all, that it had gone. That this thing that obsessed me and interested me and fascinated me for so long that had completely gone, and I told him this. And this occurred to me, once you cross the line, then you're only interested in death. Death is the only, you know. First of all, it's sexuality, and then it's death. Death is the only subject, actually, you realize after a certain age, and you've had it, and you think, why are all these people thinking about sex? My God, they must be crazy. There's much more important things to think about. But I guess being young for ages, which I was, and having had a young person's body for a very long time, I was very interested in passion. I was interested in the way the unconscious disrupts your life. I was interested in what people want to do with one another, why they want to be together. After all, for a long time you're a child and you're living in a marriage, actually. You live in lots of marriages, don't you, in your life? But the first marriage you live in is somebody else's marriage called your parents. And you wonder all the time what they're doing together. You know, sometimes I'm lying in bed and I can see through the door my boy watching, and I think, he's watching these people. What are they doing? Who are they? You know, he's in another marriage. And so passion, sexuality, the use of other people, the way that sexuality overwhelms you, you know, because we are romantics in the English poetry sense, and in the other sense, we believe in sexual passion that would deliver us into love, and we will stay in love and so on. That these ideas about sexual passion and love are right at the center of our culture. You know, all French 19th century great novels are about sex. You know, Balzac, Stendhal, Madame Bovary is about a woman who doesn't want to have sex with her husband, seems to me. So it has to be right at the center of our concerns. But it seems to me to be a wider question, not only about sex, but about pleasure, really, which is much more interesting than sex. The pleasure of other people, why you want to be with other people, you know, and what it is, what pleasure it is you get from them and they get from you, and what happens, as in my novel Intimacy, when the pleasure runs out, when you look at them in the morning and you hate them. you look at this person and you hate them, and they hate you, for instance, which is the end of your pleasure, or a different kind of pleasure, the pleasure of hating. So I guess it's thinking about that stuff, thinking about why people want to stand close to one another, why they want to be with each other, for instance, I guess, which can be sexual, but also it's really to do with a passion. Or why you like other people. Why it is you're drawn to certain people. Certain people interest you, and you can see that you interest them for reasons you never quite understand, which is clearly unconscious in some way and probably is sexual in some other way. Also, sex, it's a good way. It's a very powerful way of telling a story. You know, most films, most literature are about people falling in love, about people wanting one another. Or suppose you suddenly fall in love with the wrong person. You know, you're walking down the street, suddenly you fall in love with somebody. You know, at that moment your life changes, and we want that to happen to us, and it does happen to us. And that is a point when you suddenly become self-conscious, or you have to make decisions about your life in all sorts of ways that you didn't before. And that is a moment, you might say, of sexual passion. But also the whole world, your whole world would change too at that moment. So I guess as a writer, you'd look for those moments of breakdown or breakthrough or falling in love or falling out of love, I guess. In order to, that's where the story would start, you'd say. Also, I guess, because we live in a society that's obsessed with sex, but in fact, when nobody talks about the fact that people hate sex and how horrible it is and how painful it is and what a ghastly experience it is having sex with other people.
Could you have the microphone far?
Oh, right. Okay.
Hello, that's another question about sexuality again. In your
As
work,
if I was an expert.
In your work, you depict like.
I can't
many,
hear you, sorry, you have to talk.
Sorry. In your work, you depict many different sexualities and, let's say, combinations. And could that be a way of saying that sexual norms or conventions are confining?
Sexual laws are and conventions are what? Confining.
Confining.
Sexual laws or conventions are confining. I guess one of the things that children are always interested in is the law. You know, where is the line? When you're with your kids, they're always trying to find out when you're going to go crazy. You know, I can say that. I can ask for that, I can do that, but there's a moment when you go nuts and you say, sorry, pal, if you do that, I'm going to turn into a very bad person, you know. And so the law, where the law is, what it is you're allowed to do, particularly sexually, what is acceptable, what is not acceptable, and so on, is a fascination to all people. It's interesting, isn't it, that most if you turn on the television, most programs are about policemen, you know. So the law, being interested in the law, both, you know, the real law, but mostly the symbolic law, i.e. the law of the parents, you know, or what Lacan calls the symbolic order, I guess, is a fascination to all of us, you know. And of course, particularly sexually, you know, in the end, the only thing that's a turn-on is the transgressive. The only thing that's exciting is to do the stuff that you're not supposed to do. Every child knows that, and every adult knows that. And I guess as a writer, you go down the line. You want to see where that line is, what is it, you know. What is it you're allowed to do? When I wrote My Beautiful Laundrette and the two boys kissed, it seemed very, very transgressive at that time. Now men kiss on television all the time, you know. But in those days, you didn't see a lot of blokes kissing on television, and you didn't see skinheads kissing Pakistanis. And so I thought at that moment, you're saying something you're showing something that's transgressive, but also it's a good way of saying something about being Asian, about being a skinhead, about laundrettes, you know, about this world. And also, of course, through the 70s and the 80s, there was the gay movement, which was very important to me and friends of mine, because it seemed that this was the vanguard of new sexualities, but also that it was similar to the feminism or similar to civil rights in America and so on. How is it that people then begin to speak their own sexuality? They begin to speak through their bodies, for instance, the truth of their lives, and it's transgressive. So I've always been interested in that. It's really the law, actually, the law and the way it works that I'm interested in, and the way sexuality has to approach the law in order to be alive, and then what happens to it, and how dangerous it is, and how then there is guilt, and then there is punishment. I guess it's thinking about that stuff.
Maybe it's a bit personal, but I was just asking myself, like, if you were, would you go for plastic surgery? And if not, why not? If yes, why? If you don't want to answer, just don't answer.
That's a very interesting, nobody's ever asked me that question before, actually. You go and see a writer give a reading and you ask him whether he... if he were to have plastic surgery, which bit of his body would he have done up? That's a really cool question. Yeah. Yes. There are bits of my body that could certainly do with some improvement, I guess, and I have lots of fantasies about the fact that if I had a different kind of body, then I would, you know, have a different life, I guess. But unfortunately, that's what writers do. You entertain an idea like that, don't you? You think, oh, it'd be great if I looked like so-and-so, and, you know, oh, the chicks would go really crazy if I was like that. And would I want that, and would that... And then instead of having it, instead of doing it, you write it down. And that's what's so boring about writers, that they don't actually go and do it. They would write a story about the idea of somebody doing this.
Do you have the feeling of another life by writing a book? Or you
yes,
have the feeling
that's
of...
right. You can live another life. You can lead the life of somebody who's had plastic surgery, let's say, or is being cloned, without having to have an anesthetic.
But is that a question of, like, narcissism? Like, you like yourself, so you want to improve your body, or is that the fact you're afraid of death, so you want to stop the process?
The book is about those questions, and that's what I'm interested in, what I've been trying to write about, yeah, yes. And what would it be like if you lived for much longer, or what, it's really a question about what gives life meaning. If you lived forever, life would be completely meaningless, there wouldn't be any pleasure in it at all. The fact that you're going to die makes your life interesting and alive at that moment. That's the only thing that makes it alive, you know, but that's a sort of dreadful thought. How do you live with that thought? The only thing that makes anybody's body attractive is the fact that their body is decaying at the same time. And so, yes, if you're a writer, you'll write this stuff down. It'd be interesting to think if writers had plastic surgery, actually, whether writers as a genus would fancy plastic surgery. It'd be very funny, wouldn't it, if you saw, I don't know, Marquez come out with a different face, with a different nose, saying, do you like my new nose?
I had a practical question. How do you write? Do you have a rhythm? Do you have a season? Do you write every day? What do you do when it doesn't flow?
People love this question. I love this question, actually. I like questions. Whenever I see people, my wife says to me, you always ask them how they get to work, which train they get on, you know, and they always ask you about which pen you use. I always write in the morning, and I start as early as I can, and I usually write till lunchtime. I'm always rather ashamed of answering this question because I don't actually work very much. I work two or three, 4 hours in the morning, and then I have lunch, and then I take it easy for the rest of the day. It's an easy job if you can get the work, I always say. Because you can't concentrate for so long. The idea that you could sit down for 12 hours and be creative is just mad, any more than you could be a dancer and dance for 12 hours. But it is like being a dancer in the sense that you have to do it all the time. You do it every day. I always try and do a bit every day. You know, Saturdays, Sundays, 6 o'clock, I would do 3 or 4 pages or whatever, you know. So you keep going. And what happens when it stops? Well, I had writer's block. But it's mostly depression. It's not just block. I mean, if you really can't speak, if you really stop, if it feels so dangerous to speak that when you speak, your parents would die at that moment, that you are defecating on your mother's face, then you are depressed. And it seems to me that there are all sorts of other psychological problems that people have that leads to them not being able to speak or to say certain things that they need to say. And often when you write, at that moment when you begin to write, you get such a surge of terror, of inhibition. Lots of you write a line and you think, my God, what will my mother say, what will my father say? They would all die, everyone would die if I say these terrible things. And it's very interesting when that starts to happen, because then you can put those other voices too into the story as well. The voice is your inhibition. So, you know, speaking at all, speaking the truth, speaking to other people, speaking to yourself, admitting things, you know, it's a nightmare, it's difficult. And as, if you're a writer, you get used to that. You write something and you think, oh, God, I shouldn't say that, that's terrible. And so on, and you begin to see that this is what being a writer is, or what speaking is for anybody. You know, it feels dangerous, and when it feels dangerous, it's usually better than when it feels safe, I guess, to do.